Hello and welcome to ID the Future. I'm Casey Luskin, broadcasting with Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture based in Seattle, Washington. We have on the show with us again today Dr. David Snoke, a professor of physics at the University of Pittsburgh, who recently has published a paper in the journal Biocomplexity about systems biology and how it relates to intelligent design. Let's pick up the conversation again with Dr. Snoke talking about systems biology. Well, Dr. Snoke, you certainly did a good job in your paper of talking about some of these assumptions made by systems biology, such as the idea that things are optimized or that there are trade-offs that biological systems are optimizing. Could you maybe discuss the additional assumptions that are made by systems biology when it investigates biological systems?
Well, yeah. So in general, this idea of teleology is a generic one, which is going on all over the place now in systems biology. And it basically was something that goes all the way back to Aristotle. Aristotle talked about different types of causes. And he talked about explaining things in terms of causes, in terms of like the history of something. So just as an example, I might say, why is there a light switch on my wall? And I might say, well, there's a light switch on the wall because at some point a electrician came in and installed it and used a certain type of wire and so on. Or I might say there's a light switch on the wall because I want there to be light in my room. So the second one is what's it for, right? The purpose of it. That's a teleological explanation. The first one would be simply a historical explanation of saying this is what happened that led to this. Now, for the last few hundred years, teleological explanations have been kind of forbidden or considered not to be good in scientific circles. But the systems biology world is explicitly embracing teleology as a starting point for how they do their work. As I said, starting with what's this for and then asking, well, how does it work? How does it do it? What kind of trade-offs are made and so on. And so there's a really fascinating article, which I quote by Arthur Lander, who is no friend of ID, who basically says we need to embrace teleology and not be embarrassed about it and simply say, yes, we're doing teleological research. And when you do that, you're saying that thinking like you're seeing a design system is the way that you're working. So just think about, how do we think about something when we think that it's design? I'm looking at a computer or I'm looking at something else. Typically, I'm asking, what was this for? That's a teleological question. That's saying, what's it good for? Now, typically, evolutionary biologists will say, well, all you're really saying in that is, what does it do? What is its actual function? And you're not really saying that it had a purpose. You're simply saying, how is it presently functioning? But what systems biology is showing is that actually gets kind of blurred because they're not just saying what is, they're saying really, what is it for? And that actually guides their thinking about it all.
So, Dr. Snoke, I think it's very interesting for you to mention that systems biology makes an assumption about teleology. But at the end of the day, as you put it, what systems biology is really about is just finding out how biology works without maybe philosophical presuppositions. If teleology is an assumption that helps us to understand biology, then systems biology says, well, then by all means, we should make that assumption. But what's interesting, and you mentioned this in your paper, is that a lot of folks who use systems biology are not necessarily friendly to ID. So what is driving them to use this approach? Is it just the fact that systems biology works, in which case, that's very interesting that what they're finding out that works, people who are not predisposed to accept ID are finding that sort of ID or teleological assumptions work. Is that sort of what's going on here?
That's a large part of it, yeah. Definitely, I would say that in the scientific world, that money speaks louder than philosophy. So if you are able to really make quantitative predictions about how things work in the biological world that allow you to do designer things and so on, there's always going to be people who run with that regardless of what the implications might have for philosophy. And so one thing I note in the paper, what's really interesting is what you don't see a lot of in systems biology is what you might call legacy issues. Let me give you an example, a well-designed system, a bad-designed system. Suppose I'm looking at home repairs in my house. I just bought a house and I have a house I got from previous owners and there was a whole series of owners before that. And so two different assumptions I might take approaching the things in the house. The one is I might say, well, actually, there's a lot of kludgy things in this house that really aren't optimal because of the history of the thing. And so somebody didn't want to rip out the old wires, so they just put new wires over top, or they didn't want to rip out a whole plumbing system, so they just tacked on a new connection. And so the water runs down to the basement and back up again. Seems kind of weird, but it was just the best way of not having to rip out a whole system. And so in general,
you have legacy issues like that. And sometimes people who are familiar with Windows operating system will say the same thing. Like, one reason why there's weird things happening in the Windows system is because of all the legacy issues of backwards compatibility. Well, it used to do this, and then they upgraded this, but they didn't upgrade that, and so on. There's precious little of that going on in systems biology. Essentially, they're looking at the system and saying it is optimized in its present form, and we don't see a lot of junk and historical stuff that is now being co-opted to do things in a semi-way. And so it's really more like saying I'm looking at a house that was freshly built with all kinds of fantastically well-optimized things going on, and very little discussion about legacy things from previous versions and things like that. Now, in the DNA world, you will have people saying, well, there's junk DNA, that's legacy DNA. That story is still not done. There's still debates about junk DNA and whether there really is junk DNA and what role that's playing and so on. But when you look at not the DNA, but the actual machines that are actually doing stuff, there's precious little that is what you might call junk.
Dr. Snoke, I think that was a very helpful aspect of your paper, was that you talked about some of the differing predictions made by Darwinism versus intelligent design, especially in the context of looking at junk DNA or useless vestigial parts. So I guess, do you think that systems biology is a useful way of testing between a Darwinian origin of a system versus a designed origin of a system?
Well, I would say, again, it's sort of which you might say is a more natural one. So in the systems biology world and the sort of standard evolutionary view, what people would say is that, yes, we have these fantastically well-designed, optimized systems. And the way that that happened was that any inefficiency led to animals being killed off. And so, you know, the inefficient ones were all killed off. And so we just have this general trend toward more and more efficiency in the evolutionary process. That's plausible, but it's far from obvious, because you've got competing things going on. If you have something which completely eliminates any inefficiency, you end up with having problems. Well, how can you ever do anything new? How can you ever have anything evolve? On the other hand, if you say we're going to allow new things to happen, then you might expect some of them will be sticking around and not exactly ideal the first time that they are produced. And so historically, many evolutionists actually have pointed to vestigial things or things that they thought were junk or non-working and very clearly trumpeted these as evidences of evolution. So you have, for instance, the panda's thumb argument or other arguments where people will point out, look at this inefficient thing going on in biology, this clearly proves evolution. It's going to be interesting to see the collision between that type of thinking and what's going on in the systems biology world in terms of which will win out, because the systems biology people don't tend to work that way. They tend to say, we're assuming this is really, really well optimized, nearly perfectly optimized. And so there are some things that are sort of ambiguous at this point. I would say the jury is still out on some of what is going on with junk DNA and so on. So I guess you could say that the intelligent design viewpoint would say clearly there's reason to expect optimization. There's also reason within the intelligent design viewpoint to expect things to be suboptimal. So people would say you could have degeneration. You could have things that work and then broke. You could also simply have a designer who wants to make things pretty and not necessarily the most efficient. So in the intelligent design perspective, there is a place for non-optimal things. On the other hand, on the Darwinian viewpoint, you would say, well, there's clearly a place for junk because of trying many things randomly. On the other hand, there's also a place for optimality and things that are doing things well because of killing off the inefficient ones. And so both points of view allow for both types of things. The issue is they don't necessarily say the same amount. The design perspective would tend to say you expect it to be mostly pretty well designed with some broken parts, whereas I would say the historical evolutionary perspective has been the opposite, say it's mostly junk with a few optimal parts. And that tends to be the way that they've argued. So sometimes it's not an all or nothing argument, but I would say that the strong use of design concepts in the systems biology world is certainly compatible with an intelligent design viewpoint. And I just don't think people have paid enough attention to how dominant that paradigm is becoming.
Yeah, I mean, we can certainly tell the difference between, say, ruins of some once great building or temple that have fallen down and aren't what they once were, but they were clearly designed. We can tell the difference between ruins and some random rock pile or a rock slide that just fell off the side of a mountain. It is possible to distinguish between a system that was the result of natural causes and one that was the result of, say, intelligent causes, but has gone through maybe some natural degeneration, you might call it. So I think this is a really interesting debate, and I think that your paper brings a lot of clarity to these questions. So thank you so much for your work, Dr. Snoke, in helping us to understand systems biology and how it applies to intelligent design.
Yeah, it's good to talk with you. And actually, I think it would be really interesting to have some meetings to invite some of these systems design people to come and talk. And they might surprise you and actually be interested in that conversation.
I think that would be a lot of fun. I know that there are some systems biology people here in Seattle. I know that they're not real fond of intelligent design, but hey, it never hurts to try. So that's a great idea.
Okay, well, good talking to you.
Yeah, thank you so much, Dr. Snoke. I'm Casey Luskin with ID the Future. Thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2014. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.